Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Marty Johnson reporting. In Saudi Arabia, there is shock as officials in Mecca are investigating the collapse of a construction crane at the Grand Mosque in the Holy City that killed at least 107 people. Another 230 others plus are injured. The incident happened as Muslims begin to gather all over the world for the annual Hajj pilgrimage set to begin later this month in Mecca. Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban has called for the massive European package of aid for Syria's neighbors to help curb the flow of migrants into the European Union. Speaking in German newspaper Bild, Mr. Orban said Syrian refugees already had a safe place to stay in the refugee camps surrounding Syria, and he maintains those coming to Europe are not seeking asylum for safety reasons, but merely a better living standard. Meantime, Peter Buchert of Human Rights Watch says the refugees are struggling as they attempt to resettle from Syria to Europe.
They spend about 36 hours in these very crowded camps. There's not enough beds, and many of them are getting sick now that the temperatures are dropping, and also from the stress of just not knowing what is going to happen to them.
Austria's Chancellor Werner Faymann argues the opposite in Der Spiegel, saying Orban is acting irresponsibly in suggesting the refugees are economic and that Austria, Germany and Sweden recognize the migrants as war refugees. Russia's expanded military support for the Syrian Assad government in Damascus is rousing concern in the United States, but Moscow says it hopes to avoid unintended incidents in Syria by staying in coordination with the U.S. U.S. officials say they are concerned that Russia might attack Western-backed insurgent groups that are involved in armed conflict with the Syrian military, and that could risk confrontation with the Western and international forces flying over Syria fighting Islamic State militants. This is VOA News. Egypt's Prime Minister Ibrahim Malab and his cabinet resigned today amid a widening corruption investigation in which the agriculture minister was arrested just days ago. President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi asked outgoing Petroleum Minister Sharif Ismail to start an interim government within the week. After accepting the resignation, key portfolio holders, the defense, interior and foreign ministers are expected to remain in the new government, which will be responsible for overseeing long-delayed parliamentary elections to take place in phases from October 17th to December 2nd. The United States House of Representatives Friday voted to reject the international deal with Iran to curb its nuclear weapons. Since the Senate held a decisive vote blocking a disapproval measure on Thursday, the House vote is largely symbolic. House Speaker John Boehner.
So our fight to stop this bad deal, frankly, is just beginning. We will not let the American people down.
The House of Representatives vote is intended to send a message to the Obama administration, which pushed hard for the deal in negotiations in the past 18 months. A cooking gas cylinder exploded today in a crowded restaurant in the central Indian city of Madhya Pradesh, killing at least 89 people and injuring others. Rescue workers and survivors search through the debris, and they're still looking for survivors. Authorities say the death toll is expected to rise. Explosions involving gas cylinders are not uncommon in India. India and Pakistan are said to have agreed to devise new mechanisms for ending ceasefire violations in the disputed Kashmir region. High School reports.
3 days of talks between senior Indian and Pakistani border security officials are underway in New Delhi. They are discussing ways to de-escalate border tensions, prevent incidents of ceasefire violations, safeguard civilians, stop the infiltration and movement of smugglers, and ensure the safe and early return of villagers who inadvertently cross the border on either side. The two sides are said to have agreed that ceasefire violations by either side will not be retaliated against immediately, and that efforts will be made to probe the incident and defuse the situation. They also agreed no action should be taken against inadvertent border crossers. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
A new study finds people who live near large dams in sub-Saharan Africa are at least 4 times more likely than others to contract malaria. The study published this month in the London-based Malaria Journal mapped locations of 1,270 existing dams, comparing their locations to the incidence of malaria, finding the heightened risk involves living 5 kilometers from the dam's perimeter. American tennis star Serena Williams was disappointed in her effort to win a Grand Slam. She won titles at the French Open, Australian Open, and Wimbledon, but was unseated in the U.S. Opens. I'm Marty Johnson.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
Everybody is underscoring the need, the importance of maintaining law and order. During the campaign,
the Electoral Commission of Tanzania warns politicians not to campaign at places of worship ahead of the upcoming elections.
We are actually discussing the implementation and how they can properly implement the permanent ceasefire, which has been now agreed upon.
South Sudanese President Salva Kiir plans to address the nation on Tuesday about the implementation of the recent peace agreement.
What I know for a fact is that he was flying to Dubai from South Korea. He had led the government delegation to go to South Korea to purchase equipment for national ID project.
And a Ugandan minister dies on a plane on his way home following an official assignment in South Korea. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The chairman of the National Electoral Commission of Tanzania has warned politicians to desist from soliciting votes at places of worship during their campaigns ahead of the upcoming October 25 general election. This after opposition party Chadema presidential candidate Edward Lowassa was accused of campaigning at a church. Electoral Commission Chairman Justice Damian Lubuva told me earlier that there would be consequences if politicians are found guilty of engaging in ethnic and religious pronouncements to win votes at places of worship.
I cited the particular clause of the guidelines, clause 2, subclause 2, which forbids use of religion, tribalism, regional sort of basis, that is expressly forbidden. So I said, this is flouting of those rules, in which case I was strongly warned them not to do it again. If they repeat, we will invoke the ethics conduct committee, in which they will be summoned. And, at the end of it, we found they have breached. They are liable to some punishments, which includes maybe being barred from further campaigns. That's what I told them.
What is the stance of the Electoral Commission per the campaign so far that you have seen, and what pieces of advice will you give them at this juncture as they campaign ahead of the election?
On the main, they have been peaceful in the sense that there's not been any sort of outbreak of violence and so on resulting from this big rally. So that one, I think I'm proud to say that so far that has not, so far it has been going on generally. Of course, you'll have some small incidents here and there. But on that one, everybody is underscoring the need, the importance of maintaining law and order, peace during the campaign, resulting on the ending with the voting on 2050 October, all over the country. For example, on 14th and on 17th, I'm invited by religious leaders, bishops, some of the Muslim leaders, sheikhs, to go and address them. But the theme is peace and security. And also, there's going to be another workshop on the 14th and 15th, which will be opened by the vice president, involving various religious leaders, political parties, and other civil societies. The theme is the same. So all over the country, everybody is hoping that the electoral process will end up peacefully.
Talking about local and international poll observers to monitor at the October 25th general election, what is the process right now?
Actually, the procedure is very simple. You apply for accreditation through the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and they will come to us. In fact, so far we have started accrediting quite a number of international and local observers. So that is really the procedure. And I think because I was busy in another meeting, I'm told the Minister of Foreign Affairs has given a statement to that effect that, well, they are welcome. And of course, they should follow the procedure that once you observe an election, you make a report back to the Electoral Commission. And with regard to results, the mandate to result, to announce the results is the National Electoral Commission on the part of the United Republic and the Zanzibar Electoral Commission on Zanzibar. That's all I can say, Peter.
What is your message to the people of Tanzania as you prepare for the elections?
Well, my message of plea to them is that first they should look forward to the 25th of October. On our part, we are getting ready. So all those who have registered, they should get ready to go and vote. I'm saying so because at the last election, 2010, the voter turnout was very low. We registered 20 million, but those who voted were less than 10 million. So to the Tanzanians, I'm saying they should get ready for voting. They should not be distracted by some of the statements being made by some of the parties that, well, we know there is going to be the stealing of votes. I'm saying, well, that is not known to us. So they should get ready for voting in numbers so that they can choose leaders of their own choice. That is my plea to the Tanzanians.
Justice Damian Lubuva is the chairman of the National Electoral Commission of Tanzania. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. South Sudanese President Salva Kiir will address the nation on Tuesday about the need to ensure a successful implementation of the ceasefire agreement. Its goal is to restore peace and stability to the world's youngest nation. This, according to Attorney Work Attorney spokesman for President Kiir. Meanwhile, security officials meet with rebel representatives in the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa in a two-day workshop mediated by IGAD. Attorney told me that the president will call on the South Sudanese people to support the full implementation of the permanent ceasefire agreement he recently signed despite expressing reservations.
Yes, it's true. The military commanders that were actually chosen for a workshop for implementation of permanent ceasefire have left Juba yesterday and they are in Addis Ababa for the purpose. It's true.
How many of them are there so far?
No, all of them. There are 12 divided into many groups. And they have included even the police.
What are some of the issues they will be discussing with the rebels organized by the mediators?
These are military personnel. They will be discussing the formation of the government. The formation of the government is left for the politicians. They are actually discussing the implementation and how they can properly implement the permanent ceasefire, which has been now agreed upon, and it was ordered by the commander-in-chief of the government forces of the SPLA. And by the so-called SPLA-SPLAIO commander-in-chief of their forces. So they are to discuss the implementation metric on the issue of ceasefire, not more than that.
Talk about issues of security, including the size of a presidential guard, a joint police force to be deployed in Juba, Bor, Malakal, Bentiu, and others. Is this information correct?
Yeah, anything to do with security is within their parameters, and it is within their jurisdiction. They can tackle it. But the presidential guard that would be here in Juba has been already addressed in the agreement, and the agreement was signed on those bases. So they cannot renegotiate on what number that should be in Juba. The presidential guard to be left in Juba. So there's no question about talking about presidential guard.
So far, how has the ceasefire been holding?
Well, the ceasefire within the last 2 days, it has been quiet. It is only on the 28, 29, and then some few days back that the rebels have been active, trying to gain control on a city, so that when they come to organize, then they organize in a, while they control one of the major cities, and that has been thwarted by the government forces. Their attacking forces were, you know, pushed back as the government forces are actually, you know, are all strict orders only to fire in self-defense, but not to go on offensive.
Has the government officially made its concerns known to IGAD and regional players about the flouting of this regulation before the supposed quiet that you expressed?
Yes, you know, the government has heard the IGAD and even the international community. Many statements were issued to the effect, and that, you know, we even asked the United States of America to fill the gap, because up to now the implementation metric, or let's say the monitoring of ceasefire, is still lacking. You know, you cannot determine as to which force is attacking and which force is defending itself. So we call even upon United States of America to ensure it monitor, you know, ceasefire before the coming into ground of those what is called transitional third-party forces, which will be monitoring the ceasefire.
What is the expectation after the conclusion of the discussions?
Well, the expectation is to see, you know, ceasefire being implemented fully. And even the president on Tuesday will be addressing the nation, you know, asking the nations and all the citizens of South Sudan to be able to cooperate with the government to ensure the full implementation of the agreement that he has signed. So the government has shown a full political will to implement the agreement, as people of South Sudan are yearning for peace, and this is what the government has to ensure them, because there must be peace in South Sudan in order for South Sudan to be able to join the rest of the nations in prosperity and development, as well as to also undo the issue of food security.
Attorney Wek Attorney is the spokesman for the South Sudanese President Salva Kiir. He spoke with me from the capital, Juba. The world's focus is on the refugee and migrant crisis in Europe, but millions of people are also on the move across Africa, escaping poverty and persecution. As Harry Ridgewell reports for VOA, migration experts say the global networks are linked and any solution must address the causes of the upheaval at source.
Corralled by armed smugglers, dozens of migrants from across West Africa line up to board a pickup truck in the city of Agadez, Niger. They're heading for Libya, from where they hope to get on a boat across the Mediterranean. It's not an easy journey. Senegalese migrant Ousmane Sonko was captured by Libyan authorities earlier this year and deported back to Dakar.
Bon, il nous a attrapé sur la mer.
He says the Libyan authorities caught them at sea and took them to a prison in very bad conditions. We were sleeping on the ground, he says. The conditions there aren't good for a human being. The world's attention is focused on the hundreds of thousands of refugees and economic migrants arriving on Europe's shores. But that is just a snapshot of a global crisis, says Amnesty International's Gauri van Gulik.
Europe is facing a crisis of how it's responding to refugees. It's not facing a refugee crisis. I mean, globally, there are 19.5 million refugees right now.
With so many people on the move, the search for a solution should focus on the source of upheaval, whether it's conflicts in the Middle East or poverty and persecution in Africa, says Michel Bombassé, West Africa specialist at the International Organization for Migration.
What's happening right now in the Mediterranean is just the last step of a long, long process that in many cases started here in West Africa.
The majority of migrants in Africa stay on the continent, but moving around is getting harder amid concerns over the economy and security. In South Africa, migrants fled an outbreak of xenophobic attacks this year by residents afraid of foreigners taking their jobs. Cameroon, Niger and Chad have deported thousands of Nigerians following attacks by the Islamist terror group Boko Haram. Again, Michel Bombassé.
In very specific areas, the presence of large numbers of sometimes of migrants, sometimes undocumented, is a concern for many governments, especially with the risk of infiltration of terrorists or armed groups of different kind.
European and African leaders are due to attend a summit in November aimed at dealing with the migrant crisis. Experts say any solution must address the lack of economic opportunities in many parts of sub-Saharan Africa. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Uganda's internal affairs minister has died. The internal affairs ministry says General Arunda Nyakairima died last night aboard a flight from South Korea to Uganda. The 56-year-old was a Ugandan army officer who served in the cabinet of Uganda as Minister of Internal Affairs since 2013. Tabu Butajira is a journalist with Uganda's newspaper, The Daily Monitor. Reporter Douglas Impuga reached him in Kampala for more about the death of the cabinet minister.
What I know for a fact is that he was flying to Dubai from South Korea. He had led the government delegation to go to South Korea to purchase equipment for national ID project. And once they boarded the plane, about 45 minutes into the flight, one of the flight attendants found, I don't think it was because the poster was unusual, but Ofwono Fondo, who is the executive director of Media Center, was saying a hostess who was coming to wake him up for breakfast found that an unusual poster and called the doctor on board to confirm that he was there.
And what about the allegations spreading on social media that two of his aides died with him?
I have no information about his aides or their death, so I don't want to comment on that.
The fact that the former coordinator of intelligence services, General Sejusa, had alleged that there are some people were said to be assassinated for opposing the Museveni succession scheme, has that raised some suspicions in Kampala?
No, at the moment there is no confirmation of what the cause of the death is. All that we of course know is that it was sudden, and there had not been a prior ill health of the general. So up until a confirmation is done as to the cause of death, I don't think it would be wise to speculate, professionally speaking. But from my standpoint, yes, all I know and I can say is his death was unexpected, it was sudden, and there was no prior indication of bad health. I know that the Uganda government is sending a team of pathologists and general practitioners and police detectives to Dubai tonight, and they're supposed to be working with their counterparts on that side to establish the exact cause of death. The UPDF Chief of Medical Services, Dr. Makumbi James, will be leading the Ugandan team, and on that team will also be one member of General Aronda's family. So up until I think those processes of medical investigations are complete, it might be unhelpful to speculate.
I see. General Aronda, although still a serving army officer, was Minister of Internal Affairs.
Yes, correct. He served in the Presidential Protection Unit, which was CPU then. He became Chief of Defense Forces, the first one to take that title after the restructuring of the military in 2005. And then 2 years ago, he was moved to the Ministry of Internal Affairs as a cabinet minister there. So that is a brief of his profile. I understand that he was actually going to connect from Dubai to Khartoum, and I do know that Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni is supposed to be visiting Khartoum on Tuesday. What I do not know is whether Aronda's planned visit to Khartoum was related to the upcoming visit of President Museveni to Khartoum, the Benin capital.
Tabu Butajira is a journalist with Uganda's newspaper, The Daily Monitor. He spoke with reporter Douglas Impuga from Kampala. Ivory Coast President Alassane Ouattara faces a fragmented opposition in his bid for re-election next month. No less than 33 candidates had applied to run, with the Constitutional Court clearing a final 10. For VOA, Emily Iob reports from the Ivorian commercial capital, Abidjan.
10 candidates, 8 men and 2 women, will compete in the October 25th presidential election in Ivory Coast. One of the questions the country's Constitutional Council had to answer was whether incumbent President Alassane Ouattara was eligible to run again. Some of his opponents claimed he did not meet all the criteria, but the council president, Mamadou Kone, concluded that he did.
L'examen du dossier de candidature de Monsieur Alassane Ouattara révèle qu'il est conforme aux...
He says after inspecting Ouattara's application, it is in keeping with the electoral legal requirement, and his name will be added to the final list of candidates to run for the presidency. Before the announcement, police deployed around the Constitutional Court building in Abidjan. The elections are expected to be a milestone in solidifying peace after years of civil war and clashes that marred the previous elections in 2010. The results were disputed, and supporters of then-president Laurent Gbagbo and opposition candidate Alassane Ouattara fought each other for months, leaving about 3,000 people dead. Ultimately, Gbagbo was arrested and Ouattara became president. Now, Ouattara and his party, the Rally of the Republicans, are seen by some observers as a favorite to win a second term as he faces a fragmented opposition. The two major parties, the Democratic Party of Ivory Coast and Gbagbo's Ivorian Popular Front, have both imploded during the past few months, with several major figures breaking away and deciding to run as independents or form their own political party. Among the candidates are former Prime Ministers Pascal Affien Nguessan and Charles Konan Bani, former Foreign Minister Amara Essi, and former Parliament Speaker Mamadou Koulibaly. Koulibaly, who founded his own party, Leader, has joined a coalition in order to take on Ouattara. Leader Secretary General Monique Pekia explains what motivated the creation of the coalition. She says they knew they could not beat candidate Ouattara on their own and that they had to team up. She says coalition members are from different political horizons and sometimes they have disagreements, but that they have a common goal, which is working for a better Ivory Coast, and that everybody is united around that goal. The electoral campaign is not to start before October 9th, but Alassane Ouattara and his political party have been saying confidently for months, the goal is not only to win, it is to win on the first round. Emily Yab for VOA News in Abidjan.
A new report warns that education is under attack in the Central African Republic, CAR, where armed groups loot schools, threaten teachers and students, and where nearly 3 years of intercommunal violence have made it too dangerous for many children to attend classes. From the United Nations viewers, Margaret Bashir has more.
The watch list on children in armed conflict report describes students walking to school in fear of being attacked or suffering invasions of armed men in their classrooms, threatening them and their teachers and damaging their schools. Watch list researcher and report author Janine Morna says the conflict has taken a heavy toll on an already weak educational system.
Insecurity has had a very chilling effect on children's access to education.
Armed groups have looted schools, taking desks and books to burn for firewood and metal roofs to sell for scrap. Schools that offer feeding programs have also had food supplies stolen. While armed groups are responsible for attacks on schools, the study found that international peacekeepers have, in some instances, established temporary bases in school buildings. Violence that erupted in December 2012 between Christian and Muslim armed groups shut most of the country's schools for nearly 2 years. Watchlist says anecdotal evidence shows that when they reopened, Muslim students did not return at the same rates as before the crisis. The report attributes this in part to fewer Muslims remaining in the CAR, and those who have stayed are sometimes too afraid to leave their areas to attend schools. In a country where more than 40% of the population is under age 14 and over 60% of the people are illiterate, diminished access to education could have long-term effects. The report recommends that CAR's transitional government and the international community take steps to strengthen the safety and security of schools. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our African collection. And then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy.
If you see your body when don't elevate, wish and well, no. If one you can't put more, Jango mziki tugusambi Gambe toba kona chongamba Jango enu tuichangi Ayelelelelele Nijangi Zina Yelelele 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 Uncle Uncle
Uncle
Uncle
Uncle
Uncle Nde tomala Atonewa Nde katomala Mama tane sipata Le kanzine
It's a mama 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 some loving, the way you moving your body from left and right, you own somebody. Na le pop, look at the men, them look at you. Everybody just feeling you,
mama, mama, just feeling you.
Tell mama, 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 you go like to the balaga, chop in the banana, oh, come and chop in the banana.
To the left, to the right, your way, to the right, your way.
Music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. It's now time for commentary and analysis by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. It is always a pleasure for me to address the audience of the Voice of America. Every week, I pay close attention to the U.S. policy towards the continent of Africa Simultaneously, I look at African opinions on and attitudes toward the United States. This week, the big question of power, which came out of the president during his meeting with the heads of state here, was also echoed when he addressed the African governments in Addis Ababa. Power Africa is a very central argument from President Obama. There are a number of arguments made by the presidency, at the White House, in the State Department, in the Energy Department, in the Commerce Department, and many other related agencies of the United States. Power Africa is very much linked to the Africans themselves. They may have different opinions based on their conflicting interests from country to country. One big issue coming out of this narrative is the decision of the Kenyan government to negotiate with the Chinese with regard to nuclear energy. This is a very interesting development with regard to Power Africa. Both the presidency here and the government in Kenya will be debating this issue, just as it was under the Kennedy administration before his assassination and the government of Ghana under Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana. The Volta Dam was a very central issue as foreign policy and domestic policy for the late Kwame Nkrumah. So the spirit of Kwame Nkrumah is back in time. And so when we are looking at African opinions on and attitudes towards energy, the legacy of Kwame Nkrumah in Ghana, the Volta Dam, and the consequences for the Ghanaians comes back today. The Ghanaians may not talk about this, but I am sure that Ghanaians who are well informed will remember déjà vu that the old issue of power is back. Chinese involvement in Africa was very limited at that time, but the Chinese were very much concerned about Africa, and this is what happened to the Trans-Am Railroad. The issue then was landlocked African countries and the question of railroads. Today, when you look at U.S. policy towards Africa, African business people will be forced by this new development. If people are willing to go back to history and see what the Kennedy administration was trying to do, and later on the LBJ administration had to do, but at that time, the overriding issue was the Cold War, Soviet power, Soviet interest. Today, if you go back to number two, you can see that one big issue for Africans in the United States again is Sierra Leone. Many Americans, many Africans, unfortunately, don't read history. And that's one reason why when we talk about Ebola, Ebola became a problem for the people of Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea, and other African countries, West African countries were affected. But people don't read history. If they read history, they will see that influenza was a disease that came from the Americans and the British affecting the Sierra Leoneans and Liberians because of their sailors. Today, when we talk about genuine relationship between African countries and the United States, the African leaders and the American leaders had the opportunity to deal with disease when they came here. When the issue went back to the African conference in Addis Ababa, disease is not given serious attention. That is why you come back to the crisis in Sierra Leone with Ebola. So foreign policy for Sierra Leone, Liberia, Guinea, and the West African countries must go back in business and come back to the United States for a serious negotiation. This is not an all-Africa issue. It has to be addressed immediately as a West African issue to deal with Ebola. And this is where influenza, malaria, and Ebola become diseases in African foreign policy, diseases in American foreign policy. And this is where you go back to the third issue, which is relevant now. You go back to Kwame Nkrumah, who tried to grapple with malaria. And malaria became a very important issue to the point that malaria became a metaphor not only for Americans, English, Germans, and other people who are interested, because you have some of these scholars and most people who are concerned about wars and disease in Africa. You go back to the writings of the late Ali Mazrui. He devoted his time to explain African problems in the Africans. When the legacies of President Obama are written after he's come, he come out of office, we will be educated fully. And I hope everyone who listened to this narrative will go back to the history books and see how disease, influenza, malaria, and now Ebola are still with us. And that's the way it is today.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nyang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and engineer for today, John Dryden. We say a big thank you for joining us tonight. I remember, as the elders say, no matter how sharp a knife is, it cannot cut its own handle. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Only days after President Salva Kiir of South Sudan signed a peace agreement seeking to end 20 months of fighting, both government and opposition forces have already violated the ceasefire called for in the agreement. Credible reports indicate fighting on both sides, especially in Upper Nile and Unity states. The UN Security Council already warned all parties that failure to abide by the ceasefire will result in new sanctions and an arms embargo. South Sudan's conflict erupted in December 2013 during a power struggle between Kiir and his former vice president Riek Machar. Fighting reopened ethnic fault lines between Kiir's Dinka and Machar's Nuer clans. Thousands of people have been killed and more than 2.2 million driven from their homes as many fled to neighboring states. Over 4.6 million people face severe food insecurity as a result of the conflict. The United States welcomed the August 29th ceasefire orders from both Kiir and Machar as a positive step toward full implementation of the peace agreement. The recent fighting, however, belies the sincerity of these leaders' commitment to peace and places the entire agreement in jeopardy. The United States calls on all parties to end the provocation and hostile engagement, and to focus on sustainable security arrangements at the upcoming security workshop. Those who stand in the way of peace will face consequences. To this end, the United States will work with Security Council partners to pursue, as needed, sanctions as authorized under UN Security Council Resolution 2206. The United States will continue to stand with all those who choose peace and are committed to faithful implementation of the agreement for the benefit of all South Sudan's people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.